You're listening to the Net Mums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry. Coming up on this week's show...
I said, what book is that from? She said, Daddy, it's not from a book. I just like red pandas. I'm like, no. She said, well, I've written a book about red pandas. I said, that's not the point. Doesn't matter if you've written a book. I mean, yeah, great. That's not going to help us on World Book Day, is it?
Hello, Net Mums pod people. I want to talk about World Book Day. We're recording this at the beginning of March, the very beginning of March, which means World Book Day is round the corner. Now, Grace has decided this year, for those of you who don't know, Grace is 8. She has decided to go as the goddess of night, Nyx, from Who Let the Gods Out, which is much better than what she wanted to go as a couple of days ago, which was Virgo from Who Let the Gods Out, which would have required silver hair. And I'm going away and leaving her father to do World Book Day. So lack of silver hair is quite appreciated. Alison, what are the twins going as?
We've got one Hungry Caterpillar and we've got one Matilda. And though we didn't have a Matilda costume, so I really wanted to use something we already had or borrow something and just that whole reuse rather than buying new. But I've ended up succumbing to the pressure and bought her a Matilda costume. So I'm sorry.
But surely Matilda just wears jeans and a T-shirt.
No, but there is like a Matilda costume, which is like a blue dress and a white cardigan and white tights and like school shoes and a red hairband. It's from like the 80s film rather than the recent one. So I succumbed and went on to Matalan and spent like 15 quid. And I just feel like the worst eco-friendly parent in the world. So never mind.
Well, I want to ask our guest what he is dressing up as, but I think you'd better do the showbiz intro first.
Let's do it. Because today on the Net Mums podcast, we are thrilled to welcome Ben Miller, whose career spans acting, comedy and writing. Best known for TV shows like The Armstrong and Miller Show, Death in Paradise and Bridgerton. He's also a best-selling...
Bridgerton!
He's also a best-selling children's author. His new book, Diary of a Big Bad Wolf, is a very funny look at traditional fairy tale characters. Ben, welcome to the Net Mums podcast.
This is so funny. I was on...
Hello, Ben.
By the way. This is so funny. I was on... I was on Amazon last night because Lana, my 8-year-old, decided she wanted to go as Frida Kahlo.
Love it.
And this is how out of touch I am. I go on Amazon, I put in Frida Kahlo costume kids. You know, I mean, talk about the naivety. Of course, sort of what comes up is, I mean, horrific, frankly. But nothing, you know, all kinds of Mexican stuff. None of it Frida Kahlo. So then, of course, I'm doing that last minute World Book Day. I think, how did I get myself in this situation? Because I've known about this for months.
Yeah.
And I found a skirt that looked, I'm looking at pictures of Frida Kahlo. It's about 11 o'clock. Pictures of Frida Kahlo because she wears flowers in her hair. And she wears big jewellery. You know, she's got, I found a skirt and I found a blouse that looks quite Frida Kahlo-ish. What I can't find is the unibrow.
Well, this is it.
It's called an eyebrow pencil. Just go and buy a black eyebrow pencil.
Yeah, you might have to draw it on.
Or Sharpie.
A Sharpie.
The day Daddy drew on my eyebrows with a Sharpie.
Daddy drew on my eyebrows with a Sharpie. That could be my next book. Yeah.
I have to say, I'm finding myself turning into a bit of a World Book Day Scrooge. Like, I love the concept of it and I love the idea behind it and encouraging kids to read. But the whole dressing up at schools thing, I'm quite a few years down the line with doing it. My eldest is 13 and I'm just a bit over it. And I really like what your school has done in the past, Wendy. You were saying that they encourage the kids to come in wearing pyjamas and bring their favourite book. And it feels like, okay, that's not putting pressure on parents, but still encouraging the reading.
I'm not a competitive parent, but I am competitive about World Book Day. So I'm
delighted. About World Book Day.
So happy she's chosen Frida Kahlo, because frankly, you're not going to get the prize for, a character from Harry Potter or something So to me, this was an exciting moment because it was like, okay, so we've got a shot at this. And she's picked a character. I was thinking actually that there isn't a sort of off the peg fancy dress for. I'm going to have to you know, what does it get the Sharpie out?
Sharpie.
I'm going to have to be a bit creative because I think the prize also goes slightly for creativity. Do you know what I mean? You know, to be fair, to really be in the running, you can see how wrong I've got, you know.
Well, you might have already
of World Book Day, haven't I?
You might have already answered my next question. So there's actor Ben, there's author Ben, there's comedian Ben. And I was going to say, what kind of dad is Daddy Ben? But clearly he's a World Book Day competitive dad. So
competitive dad. Is the actor coming out of me, I think. Because I kind of, Alana is also quite into acting. And she did say quite late last night that she should have changed her mind and wanted to go as a red panda. And I'm like, no, that is not, you're not going to get a prize for going as a red panda. You know, Red Panda is off the table.
Which book is that from? Is that from the Disney?
Well, exactly. I said, what book is that from? She said, Daddy, it's not from a book. I just like red pandas. I'm like, no, 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 no. She said, well, I've written a book about red pandas. I said, that's not the point. Doesn't matter if you've written a book.
I mean, it's impressive, but great. It doesn't
That's not going to help us on World Book Day, is it? I said, you've got to pick, you know.
Oh, poor Alana.
Well, what happened to Frida Kahlo? What happened to Frida Kahlo? You said you wanted to go as Frida Kahlo. And so eventually she cracked and, yeah.
You're going to have to tell us if you win now. I'm going to be on tenterhooks next week.
Yeah, we need to know. We need to know. So Ben, Wendy and I, we are older girls, are kind of 12 and 13. And every guest that comes on who has got older kids, we try and glean some sort of parenting wisdom from them. So your eldest is in his late teens, isn't he? So I feel like...
He's turning 18 in the summer. Yeah.
You must have something, some sort of wisdom that you can pass on to us and parents listening who haven't quite yet got into the teenage years. Hit us with it,
Well, it's
please.
Funny, isn't it? I think First of all, I want to preface this by saying before I, you know, came on the show, I was thinking, and I think only a parent would do this. I was thinking, oh, am I qualified to talk about parenting? And then I thought, I mean, I literally have one son who's nearly 18. We're taking him to look at a university tomorrow. I've got an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old. Done a lot of parenting, but you never sort of feel... feel qualified to give any advice. All I can say is what's surprised me is particularly my 18-year-old son just didn't speak. We used to call him Silent Bob from about the age of 14 to 16 and a half, maybe. He just really didn't speak. You could ask him any, you know, you could... subjects, you could try and talk to him about subjects you knew he was interested in, or, you know, what did you do yesterday, what happened at school, you know, he'd get back from a holiday and you'd say, what did you think of Thailand, and there would be no answer. It was just like complete silent Bob. And then overnight he became a grown-up. It was the strangest thing. And then suddenly in conversations he feels older than me. It feels like I should be asking him for advice. He's quite sorted about a lot of stuff. And I just think it's just very, very, I think you just never know what you're going to get. And I think it just keeps changing, doesn't it? It just keeps changing completely. But I have been amazed with how he has changed over the last couple of years. He also got an ADHD diagnosis. He started taking medication about 18 months ago. And I think that might be part of it. He's one of the youngest in his year, so he's got July birthdays, so he's almost a year younger than some of the other kids in his year, and I think that probably damaged his confidence for a while. But it's been really fascinating. That's the first thing. The changes that happen are so dramatic sometimes, and you don't really know where they come from. The second thing is, I don't really know what our part as parents in that was. You know, I don't know that it was anything, really. I mean, it just felt like it's a bit like that, you know, Hans Christian Andersen story, you know, the Ugly Duckling. It sort of overnight just became this beautiful swan. And you feel like maybe that's just, you know, maybe that's just our nature, you know, that we kind of go into this it's a strange phase, the those adolescent years, isn't it? You know, you're just on the brink of it, aren't you? You know, you go into this really extraordinary phase, because I love teenagers, by the way, because I can remember my own teenage years so vividly. It's really, I think, helped me as a parent, because I really I identify with all my kids, because I've never really grown up. But I think particularly with the teenager, I remember those years really, really well. I, in all honesty, don't really remember what it was like to be four, but I do remember what it was like to be 14.
Have you read Quentin Blake's book called Zagazoo?
No, sounds brilliant.
So it's the picture book version of The Ugly Duckling, basically. And it's this wonderful book that exactly exemplifies what you've just said. This lovely couple meet, and then someone drops a baby out of the sky, and they look after this baby. And then one day the baby turns into a Tasmanian devil. And then the next day the baby turns into kind of this big hairy sloth-like thing. And then it goes through all of the things the baby turns into as toddlerhood and young baby. And then one day the baby comes downstairs and offers them a cup of tea and is a perfectly lovely human. And they've turned into two clattering, chattering storks. And I buy it for every new parent. It's my kind of go-to new parent gift, because it's exactly what you've just said. You kind of go through these phases where, oh, look, today they're a Tasmanian devil. And then suddenly they're a swan. It's just, I think it's such a good description.
And you have these conversations amongst yourselves, don't you? You sort of say, well, maybe it's hormones. You know, they have a lot of hormones at this age. And then they start behaving in, you know, a slightly different way, you know, talking about your seven-year-old or something. And then, you know, I don't know, then some other weird phase begins when they're 9 and a half. And you think, well, you know, things have changed a bit at school. You know, their friendship group has changed. You know, maybe that's causing them, you know, maybe that's, you know, that's unsettling them. The truth is, I honestly don't know whether we just search for reasons and can't really, because we can't really deal with the fact that human beings are so extraordinary and so unpredictable and so complex. We can't ever really, parenting, that's what I'm trying to get to say, is sort of parenting is kind of an impossible task, isn't it? It certainly is from where I stand, because what you hope yourself to be capable of and what you are actually able to achieve, there's such a huge difference between the two. That I don't know. I always, you sort of feel always sort of slightly unqualified. And I wonder if your job really is just as a witness,
just roll with the punches.
Up. You know, it's basically just, so you can just tell them, you know, basically just fill them in on what happened when they were just sleeping for 3 years.
I was speaking to a coach, like a certified coach the other day, and she was saying that as long as you get it right, parenting-wise, 20 to 30% of the time, then they'll be okay. Like that, I feel like that's a really reassuring piece of information to have. Like, you're not expected to get it right 100% of the time. I was like, okay, I can do that.
That does sound more manageable. I think when faced with any task, I think thinking, if I can complete 20 to 30% of this, that's probably quite a good... That's quite a good...
It's a good thing to aim for.
Do you run your book ideas past the kids, Ben, before pitching them to the publishers? And what do you do if they say, nah, Dad, that shit?
I just don't bother with it. I mean, I try all the ideas out on them. Not only that, I pay real attention to what they like to read and what they talk about in the car and what they're learning at school and what their sort of areas of interest are. You know, kids are pretty, lots of kids get very enthusiastic. I remember Harrison, for example, having a time when he was completely obsessed with pirates, you know, and he would like love to read pirate stories and dress up as a pirate. And you kind of think, and I always think with something like that, well, that's interesting. It's interesting that kids really like pirates. I like pirates too. I loved pirate stories when I was a kid. What kind of pirate story would I have really liked to have read? So I kind of approach it in sort of both ways. I think about what I would have liked to have read when I was that age, because I absolutely loved reading when I was a kid, and I really got going when I, you know, sort of about I think I was about 9 years old, and I really, really got going, and I really got into books. And having my parents being English teachers, there were lots of, and having a brilliant local library, there were lots of fantastic books around. So I also have a really great store of books that I loved when I was a kid that I also give to them to see if those kind of stories and those kind of themes interest them. But I really look for what interests kids first, and then try and find what my excitement is within that, you know, within that kind of story. I always love fairy tales. So at the moment I'm writing these books. So I've got a book called The Diary of a Big Bad Wolf. Basically because I want to tell fairy tales from a sort of new point of view. And the reason for that is my kids love fairy tales. I think fairy tales do something. Fairy tales not only are about magic, but they are magical. They have a magical effect on us and on children. It's really fabulous little lessons in fairy tales. Obviously, the main lesson often being that, you know, kids don't need grown-ups. They can do things very well for themselves. Thank you very much. They're quite empowering, fairy tales. I think that's one of the reasons kids love them. But I also really enjoy them myself. And so when I'm having an idea, like for Diary of a Big Bad Wolf, I'll just say, you know, what do you think of this? What do you know about the story of Little Red Riding Hood? What do you like about that other, you know, what do you like about that story? What do you think of the wolf? You know,
I think the whole retelling of fairy tale stories is such a brilliant way of just, I guess, refreshing old stories. Tell us a bit more about your new book, Diary of a Big Bad Wolf. So I've got to say, it sounds absolutely brilliant.
So my idea is, for the last few Christmases, I've written three diaries of Christmas elves. So it's really, they're the story of Christmas, really, told through the eyes of one of the, a couple of the elves that work in Santa's workshop. And I really, really love the diary form. I was just really, I've always loved sort of Adrian Mole and Bridget Jones and those sort of, it's, I just find those diaries very, very funny. I thought, I really wanted to do something a bit like the Ladybird series. I wanted to sort of retell fairy tales for kids. And then I thought it would be a wonderful thing if I could write the diaries of not the main characters. Because we tend to tell Little Red Riding Hood from the point of view of Little Red. But I was thinking, wouldn't it be fun to hear that story from the point of view of the wolf? What was going through his mind? What was he thinking when he thought he could dress up as Grandma? Yeah, exactly. what was going through his mind when he came up with that plan? And that was really it's been really fun, actually. And I'm also working with an amazing illustrator called Elisa Paganelli, who really brings the stories to life. And I can't express really how amazing it is to see her drawings and to work those back into the story. And that's a big part of it as well. You know, it's not just children really, really, particularly at this age that I'm writing for, which is sort of 8 to 12, you know, they really have a very different relationship with pictures than grown-ups do. And it's so important that they've got that element as well, I think.
So what inspired you? How did you get from, I'm knocking everything over on my desk, sorry. How did you get from Death in Paradise to writing children's
books?
Sounded
like a medicine ball. Sounded like you've got a medicine ball on there.
Just a notebook.
Off and,
no, just bashed a notebook.
From Death in Paradise to writing children's books. I think, when I was doing Death in Paradise, I was also writing books. I was writing science books. I wrote a few non-fiction books. I wrote one called It's Not Rocket Science, which is kind of science for creative people. And then I wrote quite a kind of, I think I was having a bit of a midlife crisis, frankly. And I wrote a story. I wrote a book about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence using science. So using our telescopes and using what we know about biology to try and figure out what alien life forms would look like.
Slightly different to buying a Ferrari. Yeah, okay.
So yeah, exactly. or starting an artisanal cheese shop. But yes, yeah. My middle-aged fantasy now is, funnily enough, I was having a coffee cart. I don't know why this keeps going to me. I kind of think I'd really like to have, speaking of Death in Paradise, I'd like to have a coffee cart. And on the coffee cart, I would like to sell the coffee that they have in Guadeloupe, which is the best coffee I've ever drunk on Death in. If you want to know why Death in Paradise is such a good show, it's because everyone is completely off their tits on Guadeloupe coffee. So it's like everyone's just quite that. High energy on it. Because the show basically runs on this amazing caffeine. Coffee that they have. Caffeine, essentially. Not just any old caffeine, but the caffeine from Guadeloupe, which is just extraordinary. Where were we? Yeah, so my midlife crisis was writing science books, and then I was at a book festival chatting idly, I have to say, to a man called Luigi Bonomi in the library, in the lobby, who turned out to be a book agent. And he asked me if I'd ever thought of writing a children's book. And I said, well, funnily enough, and this was true, I'd written a little Christmas story for my oldest son. And I'd read it to him every Christmas because basically when he was 9, he told me he wasn't sure he believed in Father Christmas anymore. So I thought, well, I've got to write a story that convinces him so we get a few more years out of this. And so I read him this story every Christmas and I sent that to Luigi. And he said, well, I think that this could be a children's book. And that became my first story.
That's so lovely. Now, it's got to be said, celebrity authors do get a bit of flack from other authors, especially children's celebrity authors. Does that bother you, or are you just too busy writing, working, counting all of your millions to even take notice of what people are saying? Yeah.
My coffee cart. Can we just talk about the coffee cart instead? So the
what I think is
it's a little van. And I think that it's got, you know, I think you open the doors at the back.
Has it got a bike on the front? You have to like pedal yourself.
Oh, that would be amazing. But I think if it does, it's just for show.
Okay.
And you open the doors at the back, and there's the little machine, and there's me in some sort of apron.
Always a penny. Got to have a penny.
A penny. You know what I mean? But a kind of
checked penny.
Yeah, thank you. A checked penny. Basically serving up mainly piccolos, which is my favourite type of coffee. I think on the...
What's a piccolo? I haven't heard of a piccolo.
Oh, a piccolo. So I discovered this in Australia. I've just been filming. I'm just showing off, really, because I've just been to Australia filming. They don't have, you know, cortados, where you have a bit of milk in your coffee. So
vaguely. Okay, so
let's just wind it right back.
A bit more than
wind
an espresso,
right back.
A bit less.
I know what a latte is. Are we in the right ballpark?
No, dear me. Oh, my goodness. Wind it right back to an espresso. So you've got an espresso, then you can add some foam, and that's a macchiato. And then if you add about the same amount of milk as there is coffee, that's a piccolo. Then if you add a little bit more milk, that's a cortado. And then... you know, it's a bit like those stages of man. way down on the right-hand side, you've got a latte. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I like a very evolved coffee. You like a less evolved coffee. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. A primitive, you know, yes. Yeah, so I'm like, yeah, that's very good. I'm
a Neanderthal man coffee.
A Neanderthal coffee. That's what I am. I'm a Neanderthal coffee.
You do know your stuff about coffee, Ben. If you haven't, by the end of this year, if you haven't opened up this coffee car, I'm going to be very disappointed.
And if there's no penny, I'm really not happy.
I've actually done a barista course. That's how serious I am. I did a barista course at the end of last year.
Wow.
And it's going to happen.
Now, can I tell you something? My husband hates coffee. It's a point of severe contention in our marriage. And I'm swearing hard here, but he bought me a coffee machine because he hates queuing in coffee shops. And so then he bought me this coffee machine. He was like, thing is, I've just bought the wittery of coffee into my own kitchen. But you are a man who loves the wittery of coffee, see?
I do. I'm with him about the coffee shops, though. It's a bit like pharmacies, isn't it? You think, what are you doing behind there? Yeah. You know, I mean, at least in a coffee shop, they are actually making a drink. Whereas in a pharmacy, you just think, all you've got to do is get that out of a drawer. I don't see why this takes 25 minutes. But anyway,
They always disappear around the back at my pharmacy, and I think they're just hiding.
Yeah, they're not even in the bit where the medicines are.
Maybe they're having a cortado.
They've got a coffee machine out there.
I think you've got
and
it.
They've got a little bit of card, and they're thinking, what's a cortado again? What's
I've forgotten what the question was.
I'm going to give you a very honest answer to your question about celebrity authors. I get very hurt when I read things like that. I feel, on the one hand, I feel slightly misunderstood by that, because I kind of think, I have been a writer all my life. I spent all my life writing. You know, I wrote comedy and then wrote comedy for other people, then wrote comedy for myself, then, you know, and I wrote radio shows, TV shows, I've written films, I've, you know, I've written nonfiction, you know, and then I love kids and I love children's stories. So, and I wrote a story for my son and then started, you know, it all began very organically for me. And I, so there's that on the one hand. And then I kind of think there's always going to be somebody who objects to what you're doing. And after I've sort of considered it for a little bit, usually in the shower in the morning, having read, because these articles occur most mornings, I kind of think to myself, well, how unoriginal of you to have written this article again about you know, celebrity books. And when you really look at this, it's all a bit of nonsense anyway. David Walliams is a very successful children's author. Do kids buy his books because he's a celebrity? I don't think so. Mine didn't. Mine had no idea who he was.
No, mine love them.
My kids love his books. And if I say to them, oh, do you know, he used to be he's actually a comedian and he used to do sketch comedy. They look at me like I'm from another planet. And they say that so couldn't be less interested. And also I would make the argument, you just say, is Stephen King a celebrity author? Because he's become famous through writing lots of very popular books. And when he publishes a book, we get to hear about it a lot, don't we? Because he's famous. Is he a celebrity author? Because he got famous writing books. Is that okay? But I don't know. I just, it's all a bit of a nonsense, isn't it, really? It's all a bit of a nonsense. I think we can all find so many reasons not to do our creative work. And I think once I start letting other people get in my head, as I clearly have done, that's no hope for me.
And I haven't helped by asking you about it, to be fair, Ben.
No, but it's a good question. I like questions like that. I like questions like that because they make you stand up and be counted, don't they? As you kind of think, well, for what are my reasons for doing this? Do I stand by those reasons? And also, where's the opinion coming from? Is it coming from somebody who is a novelist and writes lots of books, or is it just coming from somebody who's got a slightly different agenda?
Mm.
What do you think?
I think that I can kind of understand people who have been like slogging away, try to write children's book for years, feeling like, oh, I walk into W.H. Smith and suddenly it's like all David Walliams and it's all celebrity authors and they've got their book deals because they've got a platform already. But equally, what you've just said is very convincing and I feel bad for having ever thought that.
Well, it took me 5 years to write my first book, I have to say. It wasn't easy to write. I think the first one's quite hard, very hard to do.
So where does Midnight come into this? Because my daughter and I read How I Became a Dog Called Midnight, and she is obsessed with dogs, so this was the one we had to read. And we have a dog called Hector. And she went through a period of about 6 weeks, which is how long she was in the very early reader stage. She was about six, so we were reading it really slowly. And she kept trying to call Hector Midnight for the whole book. Aww. And, of course, Hector is like, what the? Who's Midnight? He doesn't answer when you call him Hector, so he sure as hell doesn't answer when you call him Midnight.
But what type of dog is Hector?
He's a three-legged golden retriever.
Oh, golden retriever. I've got a golden doodle, next to the poodle.
But I loved how funny it was. That was for me.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask if that humour is it's obviously it runs through all of your books, but trying to get a 7-year-old to read, it's really important that it's funny because it keeps them going.
I think so Midnight was my fourth book. Basically, I wrote a book for each of my children. I wrote a book for Jackson, which is The Night I Met Father Christmas. That was based on the original story. Then I wrote one with Harrison as the main character called The Boy Who Made the World Disappear. Then I wrote one for Lana called The Day I Fell Into a Fairy Tale. And they are the main characters in those stories. But obviously after three books, I then ran out of children. So then I decided I'd write a story about our dog. And we had, our dog wasn't called Midnight, but she was enormous. And she was they're called Black Russian Terriers, BRTs, or Russian Bear Terriers sometimes. And her mother had been called Midnight. And she was just enormous. I used to kind of look at her thinking, you look a bit like a man in a bear suit. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be funny if somebody swapped bodies with a dog? And I've always loved dogs. And as a kid, I always wanted to become other animals. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to do a body swap story about a rather than doing the sort of Freaky Friday story those body swaps already exist between people. I thought it would be fun to do one between a boy and a dog. And also I just thought it would be funny because if you're a boy inside a dog, then that's very, very funny because you can't talk to anybody and you can't. And if you're a bit even funnier, to be a dog inside a boy who's suddenly capable of getting anything they want from the fridge or suddenly feels the temptation to sniff another person's bottom, you know, and all the rest of it. I just thought, well, this could be really, really fun. But so you're right. I mean, I love to have, I love the stories to be entertaining and I love them to be funny because I think that is very important for children of this age. But I also like there to be some sort of meaning to it as well and some sort of message. The one in that case being, don't swap bodies with a dog.
Very important message, isn't it? So, Ben, as an author, what is it like promoting literacy and a love of reading among children? I mean, Wendy's just said that age 6, which is, I think, really young to be reading, you know, one of these books. So that's pretty really impressive. Yeah. It must be amazing to hear that these kids are getting into reading and loving reading because of your books.
It's extraordinary. I don't think we still really understand why reading is so important for children. But what seems to be the case is that reading physical books as well is more beneficial than reading on screens. Something to do with the way your brain processes the information. And one of the theories that's bandied about, I don't know how well tested it is that as humans, we never evolved to read, really. We can't read. It takes a lot of time and effort for us to learn to read. You know, that 5-6 years old when you're just picking up your first, you know, maybe picking up your first chapter books and you're trying to make sense of a story through the print on a page. What is going on apparently is your brain is being completely rewired. Your brain is having to completely rewire itself in order to do that task. So one of the reasons, I mean, there are so many great things kids get from reading. They learn about the world. They learn empathy. That, you know, there's it's obviously we all communicate using the printed word. So that's tremendously useful in later life. But apparently one of the most important things about it is that your brain is being reconfigured and is then capable of doing tasks later in life it never could have done if it hadn't been rewired in order to read.
Wow.
So we think that's what's going on. Certainly the evidence, that's a hard theory to prove, obviously, but you know, certainly the evidence seems to bear it out and that the outcomes for children, if they read and if they are read to, the outcomes for children are just so good if they keep up with their reading. And obviously there's a lot of other things connected with that. It's the types of families that tend to read that I'm sure skew the data, but there seems to be this sort of undeniable core that's to do with rewiring your brain in order to read, and therefore having smarts that you otherwise wouldn't have in later life.
What's it like meeting the kid super fans? Because I guess it's quite different to meeting your adult fans.
It melt your heart, honestly. You sort of it's just so moving. I'm doing some school visits next week, and you go and it's fantastic. It's a lot.
Please tell me you're dressing as Frida Kahlo. And you do. Maybe that's what it is. She shouldn't dress as her. You might have to. Or surely you've got to go as the Big Bad Wolf.
I got to go as the Big Bad Wolf. I have been looking for a costume actually online, and that I haven't found one yet. But this doesn't mean that it doesn't mean there's not one out there. I think you give the talk, and it's really, really fun, and the kids get very involved. But then often I'll meet them afterwards, and it's like you say, the super readers, the kids who've got all your books, and they want to talk to you about the characters, and at some point they might say something like, I wasn't interested in reading until I read one of your books, and now I read a lot. And then you can't, it's hard to keep it together, frankly, because
wobbly lip.
Such a really wobbly lip time. And they are, I mean, I love my readers for several. I love their imaginations. I love their enthusiasm, but I really, really love the fact that, you know, at the age that I write for, there's not a whiff of cynicism. There's nothing cynical about them. They're just very, very open-hearted, and they want to learn about the world. They want to, they're smart. They've got all the reasoning and logic that they might have in later life. They're capable of living in their imaginations in a way that, you know, when we get a bit older, we probably aren't quite. We don't find it that easy to do. And it's just because you know it's important. You know how much you want your own kids to read and get into books. And when a child says that they love your books and they can't wait to read the next one, it's very, very fulfilling. And I think that was one of the things that I really connected with earlier on. And I guess, I don't know, some part, you know, as I say, my parents were teachers, and, you know, education was an incredibly important thing, particularly on the Welsh side of my family. Everyone was obsessed with education. My auntie became a teacher as well. And I think there's some element of that as well, as we feel like, you know, the power and the strength of education and how important that is, and the sense of possibility, you know, and kids, when kids start reading for themselves, and they become that magical thing, the motivated self-reader, then the world is their oyster, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. So before we let you go, can we briefly talk about the wealth of TV and film work that you've done? It's really hard to pick a favourite. I've already mentioned Death in Paradise, but there's also Paddington, Bridgerton, Johnny English. Wendy, what's your favourite Ben Miller work?
Well, I'm going to be honest, I love Bridgerton, but it's not necessarily because of Ben.
Can I say, insulting. I had no idea all that was going on when I was on set.
Really?
I had absolutely no idea. Well, think about, I thought it was a sort of drawing room. I thought it was a drawing room drama, you know, maybe about boxing.
Well, it happened in the drawing room.
So yeah, I'm sure it happened everywhere from what I heard. But I think I was amazed. It was a bit like discovering that all your friends at school have had a party and you've not been invited.
So maybe Bridgerton, Death in Paradise reminds me of times that my dad loves Death in Paradise, so we'd sit and watch that together. But I think maybe Bridgerton and always Paddington.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think it's a bit random, but I'm going to go with Moving Wallpaper, which was like the late noughties ITV comedy.
Never even heard of it.
I loved that. I was gutted when they cancelled that. I think it was ahead of its time. I think it was ahead of its time. I think that if it came back now, it would be massive.
So what's your favourite?
My favourite is a show called The Worst Week of My Life, which I really enjoy, that was on BBC One, that I did with Alison Steadman. She played my mother-in-law. It was just very, very fun. Basically, the sort of setup was that I was this really I was the son-in-law, the sort of hapless son-in-law who would just cause absolute mayhem in this absolutely sort of idyllic kind of world that my parents-in-law inhabited. You know, he's a judge and she was a kind of a sort of lady who lunches, and you know, my wife's family was sort of quite posh and I wasn't posh, and I kept you know, it's a slapstick comedy basically, where I continually do things like, you know, get drunk and climb into bed with my mother-in-law by mistake and things. It's really fun. I quite like that one. And I have to say as well, I love the show that I'm doing at the moment. Professor T is a really good crime drama on ITV, and a very complex character. You know, a professor of criminology who helps the police solve, you know, these sort of baffling crimes. It's all set in Cambridge, which is very beautiful. It's kind of, yeah, that's also really fun to do.
So what's next?
Yeah.
Books, film, acting, what's coming up?
Well, we're about to go film another series of Professor T. That's just about to come on. The season three is just about to start. And season four, we're about to start filming. But maybe the next thing to come out would be, I've been working on this comedy show in Australia. The main character is played by Michael Theo from Love on the Spectrum. I don't know if you've seen that show, but he's just one of the standout characters in Love on the Spectrum. And, you know, he's playing a version of himself. And the sort of premise is that I go to Australia on a book tour, and he turns up to one of my book events and tells me he's my son. And I then sort of have to sort of, you know, I'm married and I've got a grown-up daughter, and there seems to be some sort of overlap with his mother and the mother of my daughter. So it all gets a bit, it all gets a bit fraught.
Complicated.
It sounds good. I can't wait for that. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been wonderful to chat to you and to talk coffee and midlife crisis and all sorts. And obviously your writing and your book and all your TV work. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've really, really enjoyed it. I must say the castle's looking. Can people see this castle?
People can see your castle, don't you worry.
For the podcast.
It looks like you're in an act. Where's your tankard of mead?
There's definitely a wench somewhere with a tankard of mead, isn't there?
We're back to Bridgerton. See? Look, it all comes back to Bridgerton.